Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction, and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace. So tonight's talk is on the Sabbasava Sutta. I know I say this often, but it's a good thing to remember that everything the Buddha taught for the 45 years of his teaching career was taught in the context of the Four Noble Truths and to develop understanding of the nature of suffering and our own contributions to stress and suffering so that it can be recognized and abandoned. And this gets right to the heart of the matter. In the Sabbasava Sutta, the Buddha teaches the ending of mental fermentations through appropriate or refined mindfulness. Again, that's what's developed through the Eightfold Path. Another word often used in the Pali Canon for fermentations is defilements. In the Vatupama Sutta, the Buddha described the defilements as greed, ill will, anger, hostility, denigration, domineering, envy, jealousy, hypocrisy, fraud, obstinacy, presumption, conceit, arrogance, vanity, and negligence. Common human problems even back then. Huh? These are also known as fetters and are sometimes listed simply as greed, aversion, and deluded or conditioned thinking, which include all those defiling mental qualities. And that sutta is in the Majjhima Nikaya. The Sabbasava Sutta. The Buddha was at Savatthi in Jita's Grove, Anatha Pandika's monastery, where he presented this teaching. Friends, the ending of the fermentations is for one who knows and understands skillful and unskillful mindfulness. Another way of saying that would be right view and wrong view. The ending of the fermentations is not possible by one who does know or understand skillful and unskillful mindfulness. When one is inappropriately mindful, fermentations arise and increase. When one is skillful in their application of mindfulness, additional fermentations do not arise, and present fermentations are abandoned. So this is an interesting commentary on the modern treatment of mindfulness. Mindfulness has become almost another religion, especially in the West. And most applications of mindfulness are very useful in helping us live better lives. But there's also hurtful applications of mindfulness. And the best example I can give is from my own background, my own experience. I'm a recovered alcoholic and drug addict. When you're using the way that I used to use and the way most addicts and compulsive get stuck, is that you cannot get the thought of the next drug or the next drink or the next piece of food or the next experience out of your mind. And you continually justify that simply because it makes you feel good. That's an aspect of wrong mindfulness, but it's still mindfulness. Mindfulness means to hold in mind or to recollect. When the Buddha taught mindfulness, he taught it in two very specific applications. One was to be the four foundations of mindfulness that we use basically in our meditation practice, and then was to be mindful of each factor of the Eightfold Path. And he teaches that, I won't get into it tonight, but he teaches that very specifically, that when you're in wrong view, to recognize it and be mindful to enter into right view. When you're in wrong intention, to recognize it, be mindful of it, and be mindful of staying in right intention, etc., going down the whole Eightfold Path. The Buddha continues, friends, there are seven ways to abandon the fermentations. There are fermentations that are to be abandoned by understanding. In one lacking instruction of the Eightfold Path, having no regard for the Dhamma or for those of integrity, meaning those that have integrated the Dhamma, this one cannot discern what is skillful to be mindful of and what is skillful to hold in mind. They are lacking the framework, in parentheses, of the Eightfold Path for clear knowing provided by that path. And what are ideas that are unskillful to be mindful of? Whatever ideas that, when held in mind, develop sensual craving or increase sensual craving. Through unskillful sensual craving, establishment of self-craving develops, continues, and increases. When sensual craving increases, ignorance does as well. So it's not just that we start in ignorance and it stays the same. If we don't do anything to change those ignorant views and the resulting behavior from that initial ignorance, our ignorance only increases. and it only continues to create more confusion, delusion, and suffering in our lives. Again, very, very practical teachings that the Buddha gave to develop lasting peace and happiness in this lifetime by recognizing what we're ignorant of. Now, when the Buddha states in Dependent Origination that all of this begins in ignorance, he's not stating that simply because we're human beings, we're just ignorant. It's a very specific ignorance, and it's ignorance of Four Noble Truths, which was the first teaching that he ever gave. And again, to repeat what I said earlier, and then everything he gave for the next 45 years of his teaching career was to develop understanding of the Four Noble Truths so that we can develop wisdom where there was once ignorance. And so, end our own contributions from ignorance into our lives, creating stress and unhappiness. And what are ideas to be appropriately mindful of? Any ideas that do not develop sensual craving or increase sensual craving. Appropriate or right mindfulness releases any sensual craving that has developed, and no establishment of craving for a self arises, and the fermentation of ignorance is now abandoned. These are ideas that are unskillful to hold in mind. Did I exist in the past? Did I not exist in the past? Will I exist in the future? Will I not exist in the future? What am I now? What am I not? And then in some of the more mystical applications, do I even really exist? And that's still a common question today. Is there any reality to who I am? And of course, that's the central question of those three marks of existence, anicca, anatta, and dukkha. Anatta is a word that is often misapplied and misunderstood, even during the Buddha's time and certainly in modern Buddhism. It's usually meant to say that there's no such thing as a self, and that the self is an experience of nothingness or emptiness, and that's not what the Buddha meant when he used that term. In fact, he was using the term in a way that was different than what other teachers were using it, which is more like what has developed in modern Buddhism. Using that word anatta, the Buddha is simply reminding us that the views that we're holding of ourselves do not constitute a self. It's not a self. Let go of the views. Hence the idea of wrong view and right view. Let go of the self. Let go of those wrong views of self. And then where have I come from? And again, those are still questions that people want answered even within modern Buddhism. When the Buddha said many, many times, this isn't the only sutta that he said this, when people would bring these questions up to him, he would either ignore the question as a way of saying that the question doesn't even deserve an answer, or he would respond by saying that it's the questions those that are confusing you, the questions themselves that are confusing you. Let go of the questions. And if you think about that, if the Buddha then started entertaining why those questions are wrong, you're just giving validity to the questions themselves. And if you look at every one of those questions that the Buddha just mentioned, they're just other ways of continuing to establish anatta, a self-referential ego self, in all these other imaginary planes of existence. When he taught the nature of suffering, and I know I say this often, but this is a good place to make this point again, he said that birth is suffering, sickness is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering. Not getting what is wanted is suffering. Getting what is not wanted is suffering. Receiving what is not wanted is suffering. And then he always concluded that description by saying, in short, the five clinging aggregates are suffering. And it's another thing that people are often confused about. What are the five clinging aggregates? The five clinging aggregates simply describe the personal experience of ongoing suffering rooted in ignorance. Let go of those views. Another word for the five clinging aggregates is simply a conditioned mind, a mind that is conditioned from that initial ignorance. The Buddha continues, holding in mind these unskillful ideas, six confused and deluded views will arise. The view that I have a self is established. The view that I have no self is also established. And this relates to modern applications of nothingness or emptiness or even annihilation. I have a self because I perceive a self. That's like that famous saying, I think, therefore I am. Just because I have an ongoing thought process, ignoring the fact that those thoughts are rooted in ignorance, that describes a self. And of course, that's the basis of dependent origination. I have a self because I perceive a self that I am not a self. And isn't that confused and discursive thinking? Again, think about this. This is something the Buddha discussed 2,600 years ago. And it's so common in the confusion that we have, not just in modern Buddhism, but in our worlds today. We don't understand who we are and where we come from and why am I having these experiences that seem to be so confusing? How do I fit into this thing? We don't have the basis for understanding that yet. I am not a self because I perceive a self. that's more confused and discursive thinking. Meaning that is just what that's saying is because I'm having this idea that I'm in control of the idea, but the idea itself is rooted in ignorance. I am constant, everlasting, eternal, and never changing. And that was a common theme of the Buddhist time, that simply because you have an existence and you can perceive that existence, that persistence itself is substantial. And that completely contradicts impermanence, anicca, doesn't it? Again, that's why those three marks of existence are so important to understand, and why it's so important to gain that specific insight into that. This is a thicket of views that binds one to endless confusion, delusion, and suffering. It binds one to endless dukkha. One who is well instructed in the Dhamma, who has developed the Eightfold Path, who has high regard for the Dhamma and those with integrity in regards to the Dhamma, discerns what ideas are skillful to be mindful of and are to be cultivated, and what ideas are unskillful to be mindful of and are to be abandoned. This one remains mindful of skillful qualities and remains free of unskillful qualities. It's an aspect of clinging conditioned mind, of anatta, of the five clinging aggregates, to attach itself and see itself in every thought, word, and idea that occurs. And that at first is usually a little hard to understand, but that's exactly what the Buddha is talking about here. It is the nature of a confused self rooted in ignorance to then see itself reflected in everything and attach itself to everything. That's the essence of clinging. When the Buddha talks about craving and clinging, it's craving that initiates that drive to see yourself in everything. And once that has been established, you are now clinging your identity to those things. That's why we become disappointed when things happen in a way that we don't want them to happen, when we don't get what we want. And it's why we crave for things that give us pleasure, because we've created an identity now of I need more of that. I always use the example of a piece of chocolate cake, because I always love chocolate cake. One piece of chocolate cake is not enough. I need to have a whole cake, and I need to have another cake in the cupboard, and another one maybe upstairs and another one downstairs, because I need it to be happy. And when that last piece of cake is gone, I'm so disappointed. I can't wait to get to the next. I'm using a very silly example, but that's the essence of craving and clinging. I can't be happy until I get another piece of chocolate cake. Of course, again, that's a very silly example, but what it ultimately points to is when anything affects these views that I'm holding of myself, and remember these views are rooted in ignorance, anything that can affect these views in any way, I'm going to have a reaction to them. And it's going to create an agitated mind state. And that agitated mind state will continue to chase after those things. And that continues that ignorance. We've now created an identity. What the Buddha said is anatta. Those views are wrong views. Let go of the views. Sorry, I just lost my place. Having developed a refined mindfulness framed by the Eightfold Path, they remain mindful of... This is stress. This is dukkha. This is the origination of stress. This is the cessation of stress. The Eightfold Path is the path developing the cessation of stress. Does anybody know what those four things are referring to? Four Noble Truths. He's pointing directly to developing understanding of these Four Noble Truths. Again, everything the Buddha taught was in the context of the Four Noble Truths. With this refined mindfulness, the fermentations of identity view, self-referential or eye-making views, confusion and grasping after and clinging to unskillful precepts and rituals, these are fermentations that are directly abandoned by right view or right understanding. There are fermentations that are to be abandoned by restraint. With the refined mindfulness developed through the framework of the Eightfold Path, this one remains restrained and not distracted by contact with the eyes or the nose or the tongue or the ear or the body or the intellect. The fermentations that would arise in those unrestrained at the six senses do not arise in one who has developed restraint. And again, that is, restraint is the direct practice of diminishing self-referential views that are rooted in ignorance. Every time we recognize something that is feeding the ego or feeding this self-referential view and practice restraint, in other words, don't engage in it, we're diminishing in a very direct way those wrong views. the Buddha continues, there are fermentations that are to be abandoned by proper use of what is necessary without creating an identity view from using those. This one uses a robe solely for protection and modesty. This one uses food not for entertainment or for intoxication or for growing large or for beautification, but simply for the survival and continuation of the body so that the Eightfold Path can be fully developed. This one uses lodging solely for protection and the enjoyment of seclusion. This one uses medicine for the purpose of curing sickness and to be free of pain and disease. The fermentations of unskillful using are abandoned by skillful using. Unskillful using would be creating an identity over the things that we naturally need in life and having to, last week I was talking about using this these things to create a status in our lives, having the biggest house or the nicest clothes, and those being important to your happiness and your view of yourself in the world. In other words, I don't want anybody to see me in that house I used to have. Look at this new house that I have. We're creating identities over those things. And once we do those things, all those things are impermanent. They're ever-changing, and we know that they're always subject to dissolution. We create incredible stress in our lives, don't we? That's what the Buddha is talking directly to that. So he knows, in fact, he talked about every human being needs four things. We need food, clothing, shelter, and medicine. Everyone needs that. But when we start creating identities, when we need to have the newest robe instead of the ratty robes that the Buddha walked around in, we're using that to create an identity, aren't we? When we need to have the best food prepared by the greatest chefs instead of a simple bowl that we got on our alms round, we're creating an identity over that. On and on and on. When we need the highest pile of leaves to sit on rather than just a little pile of leaves, why are we doing it? We're creating an identity. We're creating that identity out of ignorance. What's the difference? As long as I have a seat, as long as I have a place to stay, as long as I have a robe to keep me warm and keep the elements off, and a little bit of medicine and food when I need it, I'm good to go. There are fermentations that are to be abandoned by tolerating. One who tolerates, who abandons reaction to worldly causes and conditions, such as cold or heat or wind, or harsh words or unpleasant situations, sensations, or nagging insects, will not give rise to fermentations and remain free of fermentations by tolerating what is occurring. And that points directly to the First Noble Truth again, that dukkha occurs. Simply as a consequence of living in the world, there are going to be things that we have to tolerate, that we'll have to tolerate if we're going to remain with a calm and peaceful mind. We are going to be subject to sickness and aging and eventually death. We are going to have experiences of not getting what we want in the moment or receiving what we'd rather not have. That's part of living life. The Buddha is specifically pointing out here that we need to be tolerant of these things. We can't change them. We can't hope to even manage them. But we can tolerate it because it's simply part of having a human life. This brings us back to what's occurring in the moment and to developing awakening, not in a thousand lifetimes in the future, but gaining awakening, full human maturity, right here in this life by understanding the First Noble Truth, the nature of suffering. The Buddha continues, there are fermentations that are to be abandoned by avoiding. One who mindfully avoids sitting in unsuitable seats prone to distraction or eye-making. This one avoids sitting with wild or harmful animals, or sitting in the brambles, or in a cesspool, or other unsuitable habitats. This one avoids association with unskillful friends. This one avoids fermentations by avoiding what is skillful to avoid. In other words, we know what will contribute to our own confusion, delusion, and suffering, yet because we don't have a framework for recognizing that, we continue with the same behavior and we have the same results. As we deepen our concentration and develop the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path, we're able to recognize those things that are unskillful and simply let them go. Again, using myself as an example, when you spend many, many years in the bottom of a vodka bottle or taking all kinds of drugs, the obvious answer is stop, isn't it? But I couldn't see it. But that obvious answer, when I gained it, worked. I stopped having those unskillful associations. I stopped having those attachments to those things. And the resulting consequences simply vanished. Now, I'm not minimizing recovering from alcoholism or drug addiction. It's a pretty intense process. But the answer is exactly what the Buddha said here. And it's the same thing when we're stuck or attached to anything. The simple answer is avoid it. Of course, most of us can't do that initially because we have such a reactive mind. Again, there's the Eightfold Path. Developing a calm and peaceful, well-concentrated mind gives us the ability to avoid what we should avoid. That which no longer serves us. Now, every one of us knows those things that hurt us. Yet, why can't we avoid it? Why do people drink themselves or smoke themselves to death or do all the other things? Maybe that don't have those severe consequences, but greatly impact our lives in a negative way, and we keep doing them? Because of craving and clinging and because of conditioned mind. It's really all we know. And unless there's something that intervenes and interrupts that thinking, we're going to just continue doing it. The Buddha continues, there are fermentations that are to be abandoned by destroying arisen thoughts or ill will or cruelty. This one abandons hurtful thoughts, words, and deeds and eliminates them from their existence. The moral and ethical factors of the Eightfold Path, right speech, action, and livelihood, speak directly to that. Again, that's why the Buddha taught it. Not so much that he was... morals and ethics are certainly deeply important to the Buddhist teachings, but it's the practical application of recognizing when I'm engaged in wrong speech, wrong action, or livelihood, and the consequences of those. Continuing ignorant views and resulting actions is the reason why those are so important to recognize and to use as a part of our Dhamma practice. Again, the Buddha taught the Eightfold Path to recognize these things. There are fermentations that are to be abandoned by developing the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. With the refined mindfulness developed through the Eightfold Path, they remain mindful of awakening, dependent on seclusion, on dispassion, on cessation, on release from clinging. They develop an understanding of the qualities of persistence, inspiration, serenity, concentration, and equanimity as factors of awakening. Having developed this understanding through the Eightfold Path, the fermentations are abandoned. When I started, after many, many years of bouncing around at different modern Buddhist schools, when I finally found what the Buddha was teaching and why, this is one of the suttas that really hit me between the eyes, because he's saying, if you want to develop awakening, if you want to develop a calm and peaceful mind, develop the Eightfold Path. That's why he taught it. The Buddha continues, when a Dhamma practitioner has abandoned the fermentations through understanding, restraint, proper using, tolerating, avoiding, destroying, and developing the Eightfold Path, this one has severed all craving and clinging and has ended all fetters. And remember the Four Noble Truths. Dukkha occurs, craving originates, and clinging perpetuates individual suffering. The Buddha speaking directly to the Second Noble Truth there. Right understanding of conceit, of eye-making. This one has ended all confusion, delusion, and unsatisfactory experiences. That's the end of the sutta. Just a few more words about it. The Sabbasava Sutta shows clearly the proper use of refined mindfulness. The Eightfold Path provides the guidance and effective framework for recognizing and abandoning mental fabrications that can only lead to ongoing confusion, delusion, and unsatisfactory experiences. In other words, anything that flows from ignorance can only continue ignorance. As concentration increases and supports the refined mindfulness to hold in mind these seven qualities, it becomes possible to recognize and abandon what is unskillful to hold in mind and to develop what is most skillful to be mindful of. Of course, that's what the Eightfold Path is for. So that's the end of the talk. Before we go around the room, any questions on the Sabbasava Sutta?
I'm just wondering how you spell that,
Sabba? I think it's S-A-B-B. S-A-B-B-A-S-A-V-A. I send out three emails a week. The reason I'm saying that, if you want to look it up, in the emails there's a link that all the articles are, so that if you want to read it before you come to class. But there's also a newsletter archive on my website, and if you go to this Wednesday, there'll be a link to that. But you can also just do a search on crossrivermeditation.com. And you'll come across that. And there's also a link to the to Tanisara Bhikkhu's translation of it on Access to Insight, so you can see it in that context too. I often will further edit most of the Pali Canon sections I take from his translations.
He's
really one of the best, if not the best.
Yeah.
And the only edits that I make are to bring them more into context, to take a lot of the repetition. Now, he's a scholarly, doing a scholarly translation, so he's trying to keep it as close to word for word as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read any of the Pali Canon, you know how repetitive it can be. I try to take some of that out and to use more modern language that keeps relevant to the Four Noble Truths. But I always keep a link to that, to where it came from my source. So, Matt, good to see you tonight. How's your practice?
It's going well. I'm having a bit of a tough time in my life at the moment, and my father's dying. So it's been a real challenge to remain peaceful in a less than peaceful mind state.
Mm-hmm.
But I notice, and I really like this sutta, because it has seven different ways for you to recognize where you're craving and clinging. And the kind of the gist of it that I get, it has to do with practicing restraint. And when things come up, when, you know, fear comes up and starts to try to take me away into the future or the past, I practice restraint and come back to the sensation of breathing in my body, and that really helps me. That really helps keep me present. So I like this sutta. This is one of the more direct, practical suttas that
Thank you for sharing that. And I know that your development of the Eightfold Path and your practical application has allowed you to remain at peace with less than peaceful mind states. The essence of the Dhamma. It doesn't mean that you think, but that your situation, oh, this is nothing, or it's really wonderful, when it's not. Developing the Dhamma, the way the Buddha taught the Dhamma, is to learn to have appropriate feelings. It doesn't mean that we don't have feelings of maybe fear or pending loss or anything, but we don't need them to be any different than they are. We don't. So the Salatha Sutta, the Sutta on the second arrow. We don't stick that second arrow of needing something to be different, including an appropriate feeling right now of fear or sadness or worry or any of that. It's appropriate to feel that when you have when the father or a loved one is dying. It should hurt, but we shouldn't need it to be any different. We shouldn't run away. We should be fully present. That's a true application of refined mindfulness. This is what should be occurring right now. It's an appropriate feeling. Another way of saying the aspects of the Eightfold Path as right view, wrong view, would be appropriate view. You know, but right view is where most people take it. I'm glad you're here tonight. Richard?
Yes.
Do you prefer Richard or Richard?
Richard Richards.
Richard, welcome to our Sangha. I'm so glad you joined us tonight. Any questions or comments?
I don't know if you understand. Sally and I are just guests for tonight because we live on the Canadian border in the Thousand Islands.
That's not that far.
It's a tough commute.
Yeah, it's a little bit. But boy, I was there a few times when I was very young. What a beautiful place.
Mm-hmm.
Alexandria, New York is one of the towns that I remember.
We live in Clayton, which is just...
Yeah, I remember that too. Wow, it is so beautiful.
So I guess the one comment for me is it'll be 12 years ago, July 1st, that I went on my first retreat to learn how to meditate. And prior to that, I really, really enjoyed alcohol.
Huh?
And I don't think I was physically addicted, but I was definitely self-medicating.
Yeah.
Enjoyed it too much. And came back from that retreat, which was only 5 days, and said to Sally, you know, I feel so good that I just want to continue this for a little while longer. And it's been 12 years or so.
Wow.
And I've been to Insight Meditation in Barre, Massachusetts,
yep,
a few times for 9-day silent retreats, and most recently I was in Oregon for a 5-day retreat that was in October.
Wow.
And it was kind of a rejuvenation of my practice.
Yeah.
So I'm feeling pretty good about that.
Yeah. You should. Congratulations on not taking a drink all these years. Again, that's a practical application. That's how it should be. Good for you. I hope you join us when you do come down into this area, though.
I'd love to.
And there's on my website, there's a card and the things you could look it up. There's years of talks and Dhamma articles. I stream these classes now too, and so you can if you're interested, you can catch them on YouTube. And we have retreats twice a year too. Our next one is just in a couple weeks, up in Hudson, New York. So I'm glad you came tonight, Sally. Nice to meet you. How was your meditation? And do you have any questions?
I'm just, it's interesting to watch my mind right now because we just drove from the West Coast here, and we arrived on Thursday night, so it was 6 days in the car, and then there was like this incredible activity around my home, and very kind of stressful, and then we drove down here, so it's interesting because I feel tired. And yet my mind is very busy right now.
Yeah. How was your meditation here? You were able to maintain the method? You recognize when you were caught up in your thoughts, came back to your breathing?
Well, I am. But, you know, I'm just, because there have been so many transitions,
mm-hmm.
and now we're going away for about 20 days. So, you know, there's just a lot of stuff passing through.
Yeah. That's primarily what meditation is for, so that we can bring our minds back to what's occurring right now, deepen that concentration. Well, I'm glad you joined us tonight.
Thank you.
Robin.
Good to
see you too. Robin, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good. Good to be here. Meditation was very good. My practice is touch and go. It's not real consistent.
Yeah, I'm glad you joined us tonight, and you're continuing with your practice. Kevin, good to see you.
Good to see you, Todd. My practice has been going pretty good. I did have more of a distracted mind this week, so it just shows you how, like the last week, it seemed like it was going great and how impermanent everything is. You expect, wow, I'm doing great, this is going to continue. Something happens where you're distracted. I like this sutta. I had a chance to read it today because I had a slow afternoon, and I'm so glad I did. It's really jam-packed. I mean,
yeah.
Yes.
It's just so incredible and so relevant, though. And it's amazing that it's so old but so relevant and seems so modern.
Isn't it? Yeah.
And I like the questions about the self. I am a self. I'm not a self. I am this. I am not. I'm not that. It's things that I've grappled with, you know, for as soon as I could start to grapple with stuff after childhood.
Yeah.
And I find, you know, I could become very fearful about those things. And I never had any guidance. You know, there was nothing in Christianity that really talked about that. It was just like one way.
Yeah.
You know, if you're good, you're going to live forever. I'm glad, in a way, to be able to abandon those views, and I hope that this can continue to help me abandon those kinds of views and feel that there is a way to be peaceful without having to know or have this a stuck view on one of those options.
Yeah. Well, and thank you for saying all that. Impermanence affects even our Dhamma practice, even a well-focused Dhamma practice. Impermanence is there. It's part of that underlying conditioned thinking. You know, it's part of the environment that we practice in, too. But ultimately, the Buddha's Dhamma allows us to live in that the ever-changing impermanent environment and still be at peace. It's part of what the part of the reason for it. These questions. There's an ongoing theme in the Pali Canon. If you read it, the wanderer Vachagoda, who comes in and out of the Buddha's life, and he asks these questions. You know, where am I? Where are you going? What happens to you after you die? And the Buddha would either sit quietly, or sometimes he would say, "Vachagoda, Vachi." It's the questions that are confusing you. Let go of the questions. And what he's pointing to is that notion of the questions themselves are seeking to establish a self in some other realm, in some way. And the Buddha never said that there's no such thing as other realms. He just said that for the purposes of developing awakening, full human maturity in this life, the questions are just a distraction. Let go of the questions. In the sutta on a handful of leaves, I can't think of the Pali name of it, the Buddha's asked, he's walking through the forest, and he's being questioned, how come you don't talk about these other like psychic powers and other realms? And the Buddha reaches down and holds up a handful of leaves. I'm kind of paraphrasing, I don't remember it exactly. And he says, what's more, the leaves in the trees or the leaves in my hand? And the monks who were with him said, well, the leaves in the trees. And the Buddha says, well, my knowledge is like that. It's like the leaves in the trees, but I only teach what's practical. I teach what's in my hand. It's all that you need to awaken. The point of the Buddha's teachings is to develop awakening, a life of lasting peace and happiness in this lifetime. Right here, right now. And it doesn't take all that long. As opposed to engaging in certain practices which were common at the Buddha's time that were portrayed almost as a reward. That if you do this long enough, in enough lifetimes, in enough future lifetimes, and keep gaining merit and merit and merit, at some point in a far distant future, you'll be granted awakening. Well, the Buddha said, that's not what I'm looking for. It was just as common during the Buddha's time as it is in our time. That's not what I want. I want to understand how I can live this lifetime, right here, right now, with a peaceful and calm mind, unaffected by the common problems of the world. And that's what he discovered, and that's what he taught. So those questions are irrelevant. And they all arise out of a misunderstanding, ignorance of what constitutes a self. Thank you for getting me inspired to say all that. Tom, good to see you.
As always, I always have so many thoughts by the time, you know, I speak. There's always so many wonderful things that are said. My practice is going well. I would say I'm starting to be a little bit more mindful of just my thoughts. And I'm now kind of going into not just my thoughts, but the feelings attached to those thoughts. And recognizing, you know, there's a lot of fear-based feelings with a lot of the thoughts I have, these continual thoughts that are going in my head. You know, as soon as I recognize that, I'm able to say, well, why am I fearful of this, whatever that is, or, you know, why do I have this emotion attached to this thought? And being able to understand the truth of the situation, understanding the truth, has seemed to allow me to get rid of some of those thoughts. So it's been good, you know, being able to have that concentration, and the more I'm, you know, consistent with the practice, builds up the concentration to be able to recognize a lot of those things and be mindful. So, you know, that's the first thing that I've really been noticing, but also I've been trying to live in more of a, trying to control less and let life just happen around me, and, you know, not try to, you know, think I can control everything that happens around me, and that's been helpful too. Really, just I've been a lot more calm recently due to those things. I've had a lot of situations where I've looked back and said, "What would I've done a year ago? Would I have been upset?" And I remember I was watching a woman pay. She was in the line in front of me, and I had two bags of mulch on my shoulder, and she's paying with change, and she's dropping it all over, and I'm thinking, it's kind of heavy, but then you know, a year ago I would have been upset about that. But I'm thinking, well, if you would have gotten a cart like a normal person, and you'd not had two bags of mulch on your shoulders, maybe it wouldn't be heavy. So, you know, just understanding, you know, a lot of the silliness that silly stress that I've created in my life throughout, you know, my lifetime, being able to see the truth is pretty liberating.
isn't it? Again, that's developing right view. That's the practical application of the Dhamma. It works in this lifetime. Again, you're developing a peaceful and calm mind. When the Buddha described an awakened human being, he avoided any kind of mystical applications or descriptions or esoteric. He said, an awakened human being's mind is calm. And isn't that enough? Why do we need more? Why do we have to add something to that? And you are also describing, Tom, I don't even know if you see it yet, but you're describing both applications of mindfulness as the Buddha taught it. You're describing the four foundations of mindfulness, being mindful of how feelings and thoughts and our reactions to those affect our quality of mind. And you're also describing being mindful of the other factors of the Eightfold Path to realize how ridiculous it is to get mad at somebody else. Again, the practical application. That's an agitated mind state that you did not develop because you practice restraint. It relates directly to this teaching. So good for you, and thank you for sharing that. This is another one of my favorite suttas, but I don't think I've come across one yet that I said wasn't one of my favorites. So it does teach a lot. There's so much in there, but again, the Buddha keeps pointing back to the Eightfold Path. Develop the Eightfold Path. That's the path. You acting like the Buddha, making believe. That's the path I taught you. Develop that path. Use it to develop restraint. Use it to develop that the ever-diminishing need for conceit, for continued eye-making, for needing anything to be different than it is. When you look at how the Buddha is often portrayed, you know, it's at peace. He's at peace no matter what's going on. That's the whole point. No matter what occurs in our lives, we can remain at peace. Even if our mind state is less than peaceful, we can be at peace. What does it mean? It means we don't need anything to be any different than it is as life occurs, including ourselves. Because why? There's always going to be dukkha. There's always going to be situations that if we need them to be different, are going to create agitation and distraction in our lives. If we learn the difference between acceptance and approval, which is what's developed through the Eightfold Path, we learn that we don't have to approve of anything, but we can remain at peace by accepting it because it's what's occurring, period. That's all for tonight. So any questions or comments before we finish with metta? I had an announcement, but I can't think of what it is. Our retreat's coming up, that's all. That's the only announcement. If you haven't, this is also online, so if you haven't signed up and you want to sign up, the sooner the better, helps my logistics. And if you haven't paid yet, the sooner the better on that, because I've got to send them some money. So we'll finish with the Karaniya Metta Sutta. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk tonight. And metta means goodwill or loving kindness, and metta is an expression or an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path, and an expression of an awakened, fully mature human being. And these are the Buddha's words from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction, and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.